reason. The sight and feel of the burrow grub unnerved her in a way that until that very moment nothing else had. Every muscle in her body seemed to burn and tingle, and she felt an overwhelming urge to run, to flee, to put as much distance between herself and the creature as she could. For there seemed to be something profoundly wrong about the burrow grub. It did not move as it should, and its obscene little mouth reminded her of a child's. And the sound it made, the horrible, horrible sound, elicited a primal loathing within her. The burrow grub paused by her elbow. Then its fat, limbless body contracted, and it hopped 4-5 inches straight up into the air, and then dove headfirst toward the inner part of her elbow. As it landed, the burrow grub divided into a dozen small, bright green centipedes, which swarmed over her arm before each chose a spot to sink its mandibles into her flesh and bore its way through her skin. The pain was too great for her to bear. She struggled against her restraints and screamed at the ceiling. But she could not escape her torment, not then, and not for a seemingly endless span of time thereafter. The iron had hurt more, but she would have preferred its touch, for the hot metal was impersonal, inanimate, and predictable. All things the burrow grub was not. There was a special horror in knowing that the cause of her pain was a creature chewing on her, and worse, that it was inside her. At the last, she lost her pride and self-control, and cried out to the goddess Gokukara for mercy, and then she began to babble as a child might, unable to stop the flow of random words coming from her mouth. And behind her, she heard Galbatorix laughing, and his enjoyment of her suffering made her hate him all the more. She blinked, slowly coming back to herself. After several moments, she realized that Murtagh and Galbatorix were gone. She had no recollection of their departure. She must have lost consciousness. The pain was less than before, but she still hurt terribly. She glanced down her body, then averted her eyes, feeling her pulse quicken. Where the centipedes had been, she was not sure whether individually they were still considered burrow grubs. Her flesh was swollen, and lines of purple blood filled the tracks they had left underneath the surface of her skin, and every track burned. It felt as if she had been lashed across the front of her body with a metal whip. She wondered if perhaps the burrow grubs were still inside of her, lying dormant while they digested their meal, or perhaps they were metamorphosing, like maggots into flies, and they would turn into something even worse. Or, and this seemed the most terrible possibility, perhaps they were laying eggs within her, and more of them would soon hatch and begin to feast on her. She shuddered and cried out with fear and frustration. The wounds made it difficult for her to remain coherent. Her vision faded in and out, and she found herself weeping, which disgusted her, but she could not stop, no matter how hard she tried. As a distraction, she fell to talking to herself, nonsense mostly, anything to bolster her resolve or focus her mind on other subjects. It helped, if only a little. She knew that Galbatorix did not want to kill her, but she feared that in his anger he had gone further than he intended. She was shaking, and her entire body felt inflamed, as if she had been stung by hundreds of bees. Willpower could sustain her for only so long. No matter how determined she was, there was a limit to what her frame could withstand. And she felt that she was well past that point. Something deep inside her seemed to have broken, and she was no longer confident that she could recover from her injuries. The door to the chamber scraped open. She forced her eyes to focus as she strained to see who was approaching. It was Murtagh. He looked down at her, his lips pinched, his nostrils flared, and a furrow between his brows. At first she thought he was angry, but then she realized he was actually worried and afraid, deathly so. The strength of his concern surprised her. She knew he regarded her with a certain liking. Why else would he have convinced Galbatorix to keep her alive? But she had not suspected that he cared for her quite so much. She tried to reassure him with a smile. It must not have come out right, for as she did, Murtagh clenched his jaw as if he was struggling to contain himself. "Try not to move," he said, and lifted his hands over her and began to murmur in the ancient language. "As if I could," she thought. His magic soon took effect, and wound by wound her pain abated, but it did not disappear entirely. She frowned at him, puzzled, and he said, "I'm sorry. I can do no more. Galbatorix would know how, but it's beyond me."
What about your Eldunari?" she asked. "Surely they can help."
He shook his head. "Young dragons all, or they were when their bodies died. They knew little of magic then, and Galbatorix has taught them almost nothing since. I'm sorry."
"Are those things still in me?"
"No, no, they're not. Galbatorix removed them once you passed out." Her relief was profound.
"Your spell didn't stop the pain."
She tried not to sound accusatory, but she could not prevent a note of anger from creeping into her voice. He grimaced.
"I'm not sure why. It ought to have. Whatever that creature is, it doesn't fit into the normal pattern of the world." "Do you know where it's from?"
"No. I only learned of it today, when Galbatorix fetched it from his inner chambers." She closed her eyes for a moment.
"Let me up.
Are you
Let me up."
Without a word, he undid her restraints. Then she got to her feet and stood swaying next to the slab, while she waited for an attack of light-headedness to recede. "Here," said Murtagh, handing her his cape. She wrapped it around her body, covering herself for both modesty and warmth, and also so that she did not have to look at the burns, scabs, blisters, and blood-filled lines that disfigured her. Limping, for among other places, the burrow grub had visited the soles of her feet, she walked to the edge of the chamber. She leaned against the wall and slowly lowered herself to the floor. Murtagh joined her, and the two of them sat staring at the opposite wall. Despite herself, she began to cry. After a while, she felt him touch her shoulder, and she jerked away. She could not help it. He had hurt her more in the past few days than anyone else ever had, and though she knew he had not wanted to do it, she could not forget that it was he who had wielded the hot iron. Even so, when she saw how her reaction stung him, she relented and reached out and took his hand. He gave her fingers a gentle squeeze, then put his arm around her shoulders and drew her close. She resisted for a moment, then relaxed into his embrace, and laid her head on his chest as she continued to cry, her quiet sobs echoing in the bare stone room. Some minutes later, she felt him move beneath her as he said,
"I'll find a way to free you, I swear. It's too late for Thorn and me, but not for you. As long as you don't pledge fealty to Galbatorix, there's still a chance I can spirit you out of Urubain."
She looked up at him and decided he meant what he said.
"How?"
she whispered.
"I haven't the slightest idea,"
he admitted with a roguish smile.
"But I will, whatever it takes. You have to promise me, though, that you won't give up, not until I've tried."
"Agreed."
"I don't think I can endure that thing again. If he puts it on me again, I'll give him whatever he wants."
"You won't have to. He doesn't intend to use the burrow grubs again."
does he intend?
Murtagh was silent for a minute more.
He's decided to start manipulating what you see, hear, feel, and taste. If that doesn't work, then he'll attack your mind directly.
You won't be able to resist him if he does. No one ever has.
Before it comes to that, though, I'm sure I'll be able to rescue you. All you have to do is keep fighting for another few days. That's it. Just another few days. How can I, if I can't trust my senses?
There is one sense he cannot feign. Murtagh twisted to look at her more directly.
Will you let me touch your mind? I won't try to read your thoughts. I only want you to know what my mind feels like, so you can recognize it, so you can recognize me in the future.
She hesitated. She knew that this was a turning point. Either she would agree to trust him, or she would refuse, and perhaps lose her only chance to avoid becoming Galbatorix's slave. Still, she remained wary of granting anyone access to her mind. Murtagh could be trying to lull her into lowering her defenses so that he could more easily install himself in her consciousness. Or it might be that he hoped to glean some piece of information by eavesdropping on her thoughts. Then she thought, why should Galbatorix resort to such tricks? He could do either of those things himself.
Murtagh is right. I wouldn't be able to resist him. If I accept Murtagh's offer, it may mean my doom. But if I refuse, my doom is inevitable. One way or another, Galbatorix will break me. It's only a matter of time. Do as you will, she said.
Murtagh nodded and half closed his eyes. In the silence of her mind, she began to recite the scrap of verse she used whenever she wanted to hide her thoughts or defend her consciousness from an intruder. She concentrated on it with all her might, determined to repel Murtagh if need be, and also determined not to think about any of the secrets it was her duty to keep hidden.
In El Harim there lived a man with yellow eyes. To me he said, beware the whispers, for they whisper lies. Do not wrestle with the demons of the dark, else upon your mind they'll place a mark. Do not listen to the shadows of the deep, else they haunt you even when you sleep.
When Murtagh's consciousness pressed against hers, she stiffened and began to recite the lines of the verse even faster.
To her surprise, his mind felt familiar. The similarities between his consciousness and, no, she could not say whose. But the similarities were striking, as were the equally prominent differences. Foremost among the differences was his anger, which lay at the center of his being like a cold black heart, clenched and unmoving, with veins of hatred snaking out to entangle the rest of his mind. But his concern for her outshone his anger. Seeing it convinced her that his solicitude was genuine, for to dissemble with one's inner self was incredibly difficult, and she did not believe that Murtagh could have deceived her so convincingly. True to his word, he made no attempt to force himself deeper into her mind, and after a few seconds he withdrew, and she again found herself alone with her thoughts. Murtagh's eyes opened fully, and he said, there now. Will you be able to recognize me if I reach out to you again? She nodded. Good. Galbatorix can do many things, but even he cannot imitate the feeling of another person's mind. I'll try to warn you before he starts to alter your senses, and I'll contact you when he stops. That way he won't be able to confuse you as to what is real and what is not. Thank you, she said,
unable to express the full extent of her gratitude in so short a phrase.
Fortunately, we have some time.
The Vardan are only 3 days hence, and the elves are fast approaching from the north. Galbatorix has gone to oversee the final placement of Urabane's defences and to discuss strategy with Lord Barst, who has command of the army now that it's garrisoned here in the city. She frowned. That boded ill. She had heard of Lord Barst, He had a fearsome reputation among the nobles of Galbatorix's court. He was said to be both keen-minded and bloody-handed, and those who were foolish enough to oppose him he crushed without mercy.
"Not you?" she asked.
"Galbatorix has other plans for me, although he's yet to share them."
"How long will he be busy with his preparations?"
"The rest of today and all of tomorrow."
"Do you think you can free me before he returns?"
"I don't know." "Probably not." A pause fell between them. Then he said,
"Now, I have a question for you. Why did you kill those men? You knew you wouldn't make it out of the citadel. Was it just to spite Galbatorix, as he said?"
She sighed and pushed herself off Murtagh's chest, so she was sitting upright. With some reluctance, he released his hold around her shoulders. She sniffed, then looked him square in the eyes.
"I couldn't just lie there and let him do whatever he wanted to me. I had to fight back. I had to show him that he hadn't broken me, and I wanted to hurt him however I could."
"So it was spite?"
"In part. What of it?"
She expected him to express disgust or condemnation at her actions, but instead he gave her an appraising look, and his lips curved in a small, knowing smile. "Then I say, well done," he replied. After a moment, she returned his smile.
"Besides," she said, "there was always a chance I might escape."
He snorted. "And dragons might start eating grass."
"Even so, I had to try."
"I understand. If I could have, I would have done the same when the twins first brought me here."
"And now?"
"I still can't. And even if I could, what purpose would it serve?" To that, she had no answer. Silence followed. And then she said,
"Murtagh, if it's not possible to free me from here, then I want your promise that you'll help me escape by other means. I wouldn't ask. I wouldn't place this burden upon you. But your assistance would make the task easier, and I may not have the opportunity to do it myself."
His lips grew thin and hard as she spoke, but he did not interrupt.
"Whatever happens, I won't allow myself to become a plaything for Galbatorix to order about as he will. I'll do anything, anything at all, to avoid that fate. Can you understand that?"
His chin dipped in a short nod.
"Then do I have your word?"
He looked down and clenched his fists, his breathing ragged.
"You do."
Murtagh was taciturn, but eventually she succeeded in drawing him out again, and they passed the time talking about matters of little import. Murtagh told her of the alterations he had made to the saddle Galbatorix had given him for Thorn, changes that Murtagh was justifiably proud of, as they allowed him to mount and dismount faster, as well as to draw his sword with less inconvenience. She told him about the market streets in Aberon, the capital of Sirda, and how as a child she had often run away from her nurse to explore them. Her favourite of the merchants had been a man of the wandering tribes. His name was Hadamanara Nodachu Taganna, but he had insisted that she call him by his familiar name, which was Taganna. He sold knives and daggers, and he always seemed to delight in showing her his wares, even though she never bought any. As she and Murtagh continued to talk, their conversation grew easier and more relaxed. Despite their unpleasant circumstances, she found that she enjoyed speaking with him. He was smart and well-educated, and he had a mordant wit that she appreciated, especially given her current predicament. Murtagh seemed to enjoy their conversation as much as she did. Still, the time came when they both recognized that it would be foolish to keep talking, for fear of being caught. So she returned to the slab, where she lay down and allowed him to strap her to the unforgiving block of stone once again. As he was about to leave, she said,
Murtagh?
He paused and turned to regard her. She hesitated for a moment, then mustered her courage and said,
Why?
She thought he understood her meaning.
Why her? Why save her? And now, why try to rescue her?
She had guessed at the answer, but she wanted to hear him say it. He stared at her for the longest while, and then in a low, hard voice, he said,
You know why.
Amid the ruins. The thick, grey clouds parted, and from his place on Sephira's back, Aragorn beheld the interior of Vroengard Island. Before them was a huge, bowl-shaped valley, encircled by the steep mountains they had seen poking through the tops of the clouds. A dense forest of spruce, pine and fir trees blanketed the sides of the mountains, as well as the foothills below, like an army of prickly soldiers marching down from the peaks. The trees were tall and mournful, and even from a distance Aragorn could see the beards of moss and lichen that hung from their heavy branches. Scraps of white mist clung to the sides of the mountains, and in several places throughout the valley, diffuse curtains of rain drifted from the ceiling of clouds. High above the valley floor, Aragorn could see a number of stone structures among the trees, tumbled, overgrown entrances to caves, the husks of burnt-out towers, grand halls with collapsed roofs, and a few smaller buildings that looked as if they might still be habitable. A dozen or more rivers flowed out of the mountains and wandered across the verdant ground until they poured into a large, still lake near the center of the valley. Around the lake lay the remnants of the Riders' city, Doru Areba. The buildings were immense, great, empty halls of such enormous proportions that many could have encompassed the whole of Carvajal. Every door was like the mouth to a vast, unexplored cavern. Every window was as tall and wide as a castle gate, and every wall was a sheer cliff. Thick mats of ivy strangled the blocks of stone, and where there was no ivy, there was moss, which meant that the buildings blended into the landscape and looked as if they had grown out of the earth itself. What little of the stone was bare tended to be a pale ochre, although patches of red, brown, and dusky blue were also visible. As with all elf-made structures, the buildings were graceful and flowing, and more attenuated than those of dwarves or humans. But they also possessed a solidity and authority that the treehouses of Ellesmere lacked. In some of them, Aragorn descried similarities to houses in Palancar Valley, and he remembered that the earliest human riders had come from that very part of Alagasia. The result was a unique style of architecture, neither entirely elvish nor entirely human. Almost all the buildings were damaged, some more severely than others. The damage seemed to radiate outward from a single point near the southern edge of the city, where a wide crater sank more than 30 feet into the ground. A copse of birch trees had taken root in the depression, and their silvery leaves shook in the gusts of the directionless breeze. The open areas within the city were overgrown with weeds and brush, while a fringe of grass surrounded each of the flagstones that formed the streets. Where the buildings had sheltered the riders' gardens from the blast that had ravaged the city, dull-coloured flowers still grew in artful designs, their shapes no doubt governed by the dictates of some long-forgotten spell. Altogether, the circular valley presented a dismal picture.
Behold, the ruins of our pride and glory, said Gleda.
Then,
Aragorn, you must cast another spell. The wording of it goes thus.
And he uttered several lines in the ancient language. It was an odd spell. The phrasing was obscure and convoluted, and Aragorn was unable to determine what it was supposed to accomplish. When he asked Gleda, the old dragon said,
There is an invisible poison here. In the air you breathe, in the ground you walk upon, and in the food you may eat, and the water you may drink. The spell will protect us against it. What poison?
Asked Sephira, her thoughts as slow as the beats of her wings. Aragorn saw from Gleda an image of the crater by the city, and the dragon said,
During the battle with the Forsworn, one of our own, an elf by the name of Thuviel, killed himself with magic, whether by design or by accident, has never been clear. But the result is what you see and what you cannot see. For the resulting explosion rendered the area unfit to live in. Those who remained here soon developed lesions upon their skin and lost their hair, and many died thereafter.
Concerned, Aragorn cast the spell, which required little energy, before he said, How could any one person, elf or not, cause so much damage? Even if Thuviel's dragon helped him, I can't think how it would be possible. Not unless his dragon was the size of a mountain.
His dragon did not help him, said Gleda. His dragon was dead. No, Thuviel wrought this destruction by himself.
But how?
The only way he could have. He converted his flesh into energy.
He made himself into a spirit?
No. The energy was without thought or structure, and once unbound, it raced outward until it dispersed.
I had not realized that a single body contained so much force.
It is not well known. But even the smallest speck of matter is equal to a great amount of energy. Matter, it seems, is merely frozen energy. Melt it, and you release a flood few can withstand. It was said that the explosion here was heard as far away as Tirm, and that the cloud of smoke that followed rose as high as the Beor Mountains.
Was it the blast that killed Glaren? Aragorn asked, referring to the one member of the Forsworn who he knew had died on Vroengard.
It was. Galbatorix and the rest of the Forsworn had a moment of warning, and so were able to shield themselves. But many of our own were not as fortunate, and thus perished.
A Sephira glided downward from the underside of the low-slung clouds. Gleda instructed her where to fly, so she altered her course, turning toward the northwestern part of the valley. Gleda named each of the mountains that she flew past, Ilthiaros, Felsved, and Narmanmast, along with Hwildrim and Tirnadrim. He also named many of the holds and fallen towers below, and he gave something of their history to Aragorn and Sephira, although only Aragorn paid heed to the old dragon's narration. Within Gleda's consciousness, Aragorn felt an ancient sorrow reawaken. The sorrow was not so much for the destruction of Doru Areba, as for the deaths of the riders, the near extinction of the dragons, and the loss of thousands of years of knowledge and wisdom, the memory of what had been, of the companionship he had once shared with the other members of his order, exacerbated Gleda's loneliness. That, along with his sorrow, created a mood of such desolation, Aragorn began to feel saddened as well. He withdrew slightly from Gleda, but still the valley seemed gloomy and melancholy, as if the land itself were mourning the fall of the riders. The lower Sephira flew, the larger the buildings appeared. As their true size became evident, Aragorn realized that what he had read in Dómir Abar Wirda was no exaggeration. The grandest of them were so enormous, Sephira would be able to fly within them. Near the edge of the abandoned city, he began to notice piles of giant white bones upon the ground, the skeletons of dragons. The sight filled him with revulsion, and yet he could not bring himself to look elsewhere. What struck him most was their size. A few of the dragons had been smaller than Sephira, but most had been far larger. The biggest, he saw, was a skeleton with ribs that he guessed were at least 80 feet long and perhaps 15 wide at their thickest. The skull alone, a huge, fierce thing covered with blotches of lichen, like a rough crag of stone, was longer and taller than the main part of Sephira's body. Even Glader, when he was still clothed in flesh, would have appeared diminutive next to the slain dragon.
"There lies Belgabad, greatest of us all," said Glader, as he noticed the object of Aragorn's attention.
Aragorn vaguely remembered the name from one of the histories he had read in Ellesmere. The author had written only that Belgabad had been present at the battle, and that he perished in the fighting, as so many had. "Who was his rider?" he asked.
"He had no rider. He was a wild dragon. For centuries he lived alone in the icy reaches of the north. But when Galbatorix and the Forsworn began to slaughter our kind, he flew to our aid."
"Was he the largest dragon ever?"
"Ever? No. But at the time, yes."
"How did he find enough to eat?"
"At that age, and at that size, dragons spend most of their time in a sleep-like trance, dreaming of whatever happens to capture their fancy, be it the turning of the stars, or the rise and fall of the mountains over the eons, or even something as small as the motion of a butterfly's wings. Already I feel the lure of such repose. But awake I am needed, and awake I shall stay. Did you know Belgabad?"
asked Sephira, forcing the words through her fatigue.
"I met him, but I did not know him. Wild dragons did not, as a rule, consort with those of us who were bonded with riders. They looked down on us for being too tame and too compliant, while we looked down on them for being too driven by their instincts, although sometimes we admired them for the same. Also, you must remember, they had no language of their own, and that created a greater difference between us than you might think. Language alters your mind in ways that are hard to explain. Wild dragons could communicate as effectively as any dwarf or elf, of course. But they did so by sharing memories, images, and sensations, not words. Only the more cunning of them chose to learn this or any other tongue."
Glader paused, and then he added,
"If I recall correctly, Belgabad was a distant ancestor of Raugmar the Black. And Raugmar, as I'm sure you remember, Sephira, was the great-great-great-grandsire of your mother, Thirdveda."
In her exhaustion, Sephira was slow to react. But at last she twisted her neck to again look at the vast skeleton.
"He must have been a good hunter to grow so big." "He was the very best," said Glader. "Then I am glad to be of his blood."
The number of bones scattered across the ground staggered Aragorn. Until then, he had fully comprehended neither the extent of the battle nor how many dragons there had once been. The sight renewed his hate for Galbatorix, and once again Aragorn swore that he would see the king dead. Sephira sank through a band of mist, the white haze rolling off the tips of her wings like tiny whirlpools set within the sky. Then a field of tangled grass rushed up at her, and she landed with a heavy jolt. Her right foreleg gave way beneath her, and she lurched to the side and fell onto her chest and shoulder, ploughing into the ground with such force that Aragorn would have impaled himself on the next spike in front of him, had it not been for his wards. Once her forward slide ceased, Sephira lay motionless, stunned by the impact. Then she slowly rolled onto her feet, folded her wings, and settled into a low crouch. The straps on the saddle creaked as she moved, the sound unnaturally loud in the hushed atmosphere that pervaded the interior of the island. Aragorn pulled loose the bands around his legs, then jumped all the way to the ground. It was wet and soft, and he dropped to one knee as his boots sank into the damp earth.
"We made it," he said, amazed.
He walked forward to Saphira's head, and when she lowered her neck so that she could look him in the eye, he placed his hands on either side of her long head and pressed his forehead against her snout.
"Thank you," he said.
He heard the snick as her eyelids closed, and then her head began to vibrate as she hummed deep in her chest. After a moment, Aragorn released her and turned to look at their surroundings. The field Saphira had landed in was on the northern outskirts of the city. Pieces of cracked masonry, some as large as Saphira herself, lay scattered throughout the grass. Aragorn was relieved she had avoided striking any. The field sloped upward, away from the city, to the base of the nearest foothill, which was covered with forest. Where field and hill met, a large paved square had been cut flat into the ground, and at the far side of the square sat a massive pile of dressed stone that stretched to the north for over half a mile. Intact, the building would have been one of the largest on the island, and certainly one of the most ornate, for among the square blocks of stone that had formed the walls, Aragorn spotted dozens of fluted pillars, as well as carved panels depicting vines and flowers and a whole host of statues, most of which were missing some combination of body parts, as if they too had participated in the battle.
"There lies the great library," said Gleyder. "Or what remains, after Galbatorix plundered it."
Aragorn slowly turned as he inspected the surrounding area. To the south of the library, he saw the faint lines of abandoned footpaths underneath the shaggy pelt of grass. The paths led away from the library to a grove of apple trees that hid the ground from view. But rising behind the trees was a jagged spar of stone well over 200 feet tall, upon which grew several gnarled junipers. A spark of excitement formed within Aragorn's chest. He was sure, but still he asked,
"Is that it? Is that the Rock of Cuthien?"
He could feel Gleyder using his eyes to look at the formation, and then the dragon said,
"It seems oddly familiar, but I cannot remember when I might have seen it before."
Aragorn needed no other confirmation.
"Come on," he said.
He waded through the waist-high grass toward the nearest path. There the grass was not quite so thick, and he could feel hard cobblestones under his feet instead of rain-soaked earth. With Saphira close behind, he hurried down the path, and together they walked through the shadowed grove of apple trees. Both of them stepped with care, for the trees seemed alert and watchful, and something about the shape of their branches was ominous, as if the trees were waiting to ensnare them with splintered claws. Without meaning to, Aragorn breathed a sigh of relief when they emerged from the grove. The Rock of Cuthien stood upon the edge of a large clearing, wherein grew a tangled pool of roses, thistles, raspberries, and water hemlock. Behind the stone prominence stood row upon row of drooping fir trees, which extended all the way back to the mountain that loomed high above. The angry chatter of squirrels echoed among the boles of the forest, but of the animals themselves not so much as a whisker was to be seen. 3 stone benches, their shapes half hidden beneath layers of roots, vines, and creepers, were situated at equal distances around the clearing. Off to the side was a willow tree, whose lattice-work trunk had once served as a bower where the riders might sit and enjoy the view. But in the past 100 years, the trunk had grown too thick for any man, elf, or dwarf to slip into the space within. Aragorn stopped at the edge of the clearing and stared at the Rock of Cuthien. Beside him, Saphira hoofed and dropped onto her belly, shaking the ground and causing him to bend his knees to keep his balance. He rubbed her on the shoulder, then turned his gaze back to the tower of rock. A sense of nervous anticipation welled up inside him. Opening his mind, Aragorn searched the clearing and the trees beyond for anyone who might be waiting to ambush them. The only living things he sensed were plants, insects, and the moles, mice, and garter snakes that lived among the brush in the clearing. Then he started to compose the spells that he hoped would allow him to detect any magical traps in the area. Before he had put more than a few words together, Glada said,
"Stop! You and Saphira are too tired for this now. Rest first. Tomorrow we can return and see what we may discover.
But
the two of you are in no condition to defend yourselves if we must fight. Whatever we are supposed to find, we'll still be here in the morn."
Aragorn hesitated, then reluctantly abandoned the spell. He knew Glada was right, but he hated to wait any longer when the completion of their quest was so close at hand. "Very well," he said, and climbed back onto Saphira. With a weary huff, she rose to her feet, then slowly turned around and trudged once more through the grove of apple trees. The heavy impact of her steps shook loose withered leaves from the canopy, one of which landed in Aragorn's lap. He picked it up and was about to throw it away when he noticed that the leaf was shaped differently than it ought to be. The teeth along the edge were longer and wider than those of any apple leaf he had seen before, and the veins formed seemingly random patterns, instead of the regular network of lines he would have expected. He picked another leaf, this one still green. Like its desiccated cousin, the fresh leaf had larger serrations and a confused map of veins.
"Ever since the battle, things here have not been as they once were," said Glada.
Aragorn frowned and tossed away the leaves. Again he heard the chatter of the squirrels, and again he failed to see any among the trees. Nor was he able to feel them with his mind, which concerned him. "If I had scales, this place would make them itch," he said to Saphira. A small puff of smoke rose from her nostrils as she snorted with amusement. From the grove she walked south, until she came to one of the many streams that flowed out of the mountains, a thin white brook that burbled softly as it tumbled over its bed of rocks. There Saphira turned and followed the water upstream to a sheltered meadow near the forefront of the evergreen forest.
"Here,"
said Saphira, and she sank to the ground. It looked a good place to make camp, and Saphira was in no condition to keep searching. So Aragorn agreed and dismounted. He paused for a moment to appreciate the view over the valley. Then he removed the saddle and the saddlebags from Saphira, whereupon she shook her head, rolled her shoulders, and then twisted her neck to nibble at a spot on the side of her chest where the straps had been chafing. Without further ado, she curled up in the grass, tucked her head under her wing, and wrapped her tail around herself.
"Do not wake me, unless something is trying to eat us," she said.
Aragorn smiled and patted her on the tail, then turned to look at the valley again. He stood there for a long while, barely thinking, content to observe and exist, without making any effort to coax meaning from the world around him. At last he fetched his bedroll, which he laid out beside Saphira. "Will you keep watch for us?" he asked Glada.
"I shall keep watch. Rest, and do not worry."
Aragorn nodded, even though Glada could not see him, and then he lowered himself onto the blankets and allowed himself to drift off into the embrace of his waking dreams. Snarlgly for Two. It was late afternoon when Aragorn opened his eyes. The blanket of clouds had broken in several places, and beams of golden light flanked the valley floor. illuminating the tops of the ruined buildings. Though the valley still looked cold and wet and unwelcoming, the light gave it a newfound majesty. For the first time, Aragorn understood why the riders had chosen to settle on the island. He yawned, and then glanced over at Saphira and lightly touched her mind. She was still asleep, lost in a dreamless slumber. Her consciousness was like a flame that had dimmed until it was little more than a smouldering coal, a coal that might just as easily go out as flare up again. The feeling unsettled him. It reminded him too much of death. So he returned to his own mind and restricted their contact to a narrow thread of thought, just enough so that he could be sure of her safety. In the forest behind him, a pair of squirrels began to swear at each other with a series of high-pitched shrieks. He frowned as he listened. Their voices sounded a bit too sharp, a bit too fast, a bit too warbly. It was as if some other creature was imitating the cries of the squirrels. The thought made his scalp prickle. He lay where he was for over an hour, listening to the shrieks and chattering that emanated from the woods, and watching the patterns of light as they played across the hills, fields, and mountains of the bowl-shaped valley. Then the gaps in the clouds closed, the sky darkened, and snow began to fall on the upper flanks of the mountains, painting them white. Aragorn rose and said to Gleda, "I'm going to gather some firewood. I'll be back in a few minutes." The dragon acknowledged him, and Aragorn carefully made his way across the meadow to the forest, doing his best to be quiet so as not to disturb Saphira. Once he was at the trees, he quickened his pace. Although there were plenty of dead branches along the verge of the forest, he wanted to stretch his legs, and if he could, find the source of the chattering. Shadows lay heavy under the trees. The air was cool and still, like that of a cave deep underground, and it smelled of fungus, rotting wood, and oozing sap. The moss and lichen that trailed from the branches were like lengths of tattered lace, stained and sodden, but still possessed of a certain delicate beauty. They partitioned the interior of the woods into cells of varying size, which made it difficult to see more than 50 feet in any direction. Aragorn used the burbling of the brook to determine his bearings as he worked his way deeper into the forest. Now that he was close to them, he saw that the evergreens were unlike those from the Spine or even from Duweldenwarden. They had clusters of 7 needles instead of 3, and though it might have been a trick of the fading light, it seemed to him as if darkness clung to the trees, like a cloak wrapped around their trunks and branches. Also, everything about the trees, from the cracks in the bark to their protruding roots to their scaled cones, everything about them had a peculiar angularity and a fierceness of line that made them appear as if they were about to pull themselves free of the earth and stride down to the city below. Aragorn shivered and loosened Brisinger in its scabbard. He had never before been in a forest that felt so menacing. It was as if the trees were angry, and as with the apple grove earlier, as if they wanted to reach out and rend his flesh from his bones. With the back of his hand, he brushed aside a swath of yellow lichen as he cautiously made his way forward. So far, he had seen no sign of game, nor had he found any evidence of wolves or bears, which puzzled him. That close to the stream, there should have been trails leading to the water. Maybe the animals avoid this part of the woods, he thought. But why? A fallen log lay across his path. He stepped over it, and his boot sank ankle-deep into a carpet of moss. An instant later, the Gedway Ignazia on his palm began to itch, and he heard a tiny chorus of "Skree, skree!" and "Skree, skra!" as a half-dozen white, worm-like grubs, each the size of one of his thumbs, burst out of the moss and began to hop away from him. Old instincts took hold, and he stopped, as he would if he had chanced upon a snake. He did not blink, he did not even breathe, as he watched the fat, obscene-looking grubs flee. At the same time, he racked his memory for any mention of them during his training in Ellesmere, but he could recall no such thing. "Gleda, what are these?" and he showed the dragon the grubs. What is their name in the ancient language? To Aragorn's dismay, Bleda said,
They are unknown to me. I have not seen their like before, nor have I heard tell of them. They are new to Vroengard, and new to Alagazia. Do not let them touch you. They may be more dangerous than they appear.
Once they had put several feet between them and Aragorn, the nameless grubs hopped higher than usual, and with a scree-crow, dove back into the moss. As they landed, they split, dividing into a swarm of green centipedes, which quickly disappeared within the tangled strands of moss. Only then did Aragorn allow himself to breathe.
They should not be,
said Gleda. He sounded troubled. Aragorn slowly lifted his boot off the moss and retreated behind the log. Examining the moss with greater care, he saw that what he had originally taken as the tips of old branches poking out of the blanket of vegetation were actually pieces of broken ribs and antlers, the remains, he thought, of one or more deer. After a moment's consideration, Aragorn turned around and began to retrace his steps, this time making sure to avoid every scrap of moss along the way, which was no easy task. Whatever had been chattering in the forest was not worth risking his life to find, especially since he suspected that there was worse than the grubs lurking among the trees. His palm kept itching, and from experience he knew that meant there was still something dangerous close by. When he could see the meadow and the blue of Saphira's scales between the trunks of the evergreens, he turned aside and walked to the brook. Moss covered the bank of the stream, so he stepped from log to stone until he was standing on a flat-topped rock in the midst of the water. There he squatted, removed his gloves, and washed his hands, face, and neck. The touch of the icy water was bracing, and within moments his ears flushed and his whole body began to feel warm. A loud chattering rang forth over the stream as he wiped the last few droplets from his neck. Moving as little as possible, he looked toward the top of the trees on the opposite bank. 30 feet up, 4 shadows sat on a branch. The shadows had large barbed plumes that extended in every direction from the black ovals of their heads. A pair of white eyes, slanted and slit-like, glowed within the middle of each oval, and the blankness of their gaze made it impossible to determine where they were looking. Most disconcerting yet, the shadows, like all shadows, had no depth. When they turned to the side, they disappeared. Without taking his eyes off them, Aragorn reached across his body and grasped Brisinga's hilt. The leftmost shadow ruffled its plumes, and then uttered the same shrieking chatter he had mistaken for a squirrel. 2 more of the wraiths did likewise, and the forest echoed with a strident clamour of their cries. Aragorn considered trying to touch their minds, but remembering the Fanghur on his way to Ellesmere, he discarded the idea as foolhardy. In a low voice, he said, Eka e frike un shortugul. I am a rider and a friend. The shadows seemed to fix their glowing eyes upon him, and for a moment all was silent, save the gentle murmuring of the brook. Then they began to chatter again, and their eyes increased in brightness until they were like pieces of white-hot iron. When after several minutes the shadows had made no move to attack him, and moreover showed no indication of departing, Aragorn rose to his feet and carefully reached out with 1 foot toward the stone behind him. The motion seemed to alarm the wraiths. They shrieked in unison. Then they shrugged and shook themselves, and in their place appeared 4 large owls with the same barbed plumes surrounding their mottled faces. They opened their yellow beaks and chattered at him, scolding him even as squirrels might. Then they took wing and flew silently off into the trees, and soon vanished behind a screen of heavy boughs.
Barzul, said Aragorn.
He jumped back the way he had come and hurried to the meadow, stopping only to pick up an armful of fallen branches. As soon as he reached Saphira, he placed the wood on the ground, knelt, and began to cast wards, as many as he could think of. Clayder recommended a spell that he had overlooked, then said,
"None of these creatures were here when Oromes and I returned after the battle. They are not as they should be. The magic that was cast here has twisted the land and those who live on it. This is an evil place now." "What creatures?"
asked Saphira. She opened her eyes and yawned, an intimidating sight. Aragorn shared his memories with her, and she said,
"You should have brought me with you. I could have eaten the grubs and the shadow birds, and then you would have had nothing to fear from them."
"Saphira." She rolled an eye at him.
"I'm hungry. Magic or not, is there any reason I should not eat these strange things?" "Because they might eat you instead, Saphira Bjartskula," said Glader. "You know the first law of hunting as well as I. Do not stalk your prey until you are sure that it is prey. Otherwise you might well end up as a meal for something else."
"I wouldn't bother looking for deer either," said Aragorn. "I doubt there are many left. Besides, it's almost dark, and even if it weren't, I'm not sure hunting here would be safe." She growled softly,
"Very well. Then I shall keep sleeping. But in the morning, I shall hunt, no matter the danger. My belly is empty, and I must eat before crossing the sea again."
True to her word, Saphira closed her eyes and promptly returned to sleep. Aragorn built a small fire, then ate a meager supper, and watched the valley grow black. He and Glader talked about their plans for the following day, and Glader told him more about the history of the island, going back to the time before the elves had arrived in Alagazia, when Vroengard had been the province of the dragons alone. Before the last of the light had faded from the sky, the old dragon said,
"Would you like to see Vroengard as it was during the Age of the Riders?"
"I would," said Aragorn.
"Then look," said Glader.
And Aragorn felt the dragon take hold of his mind, and into it pour a stream of images and sensations. Aragorn's vision shifted, and atop the landscape he beheld a ghostly twin of the valley. The memory was of the valley in twilight, even as it was at the present. The sky was free of clouds, and a multitude of stars shone twinkling and gleaming over the great ring of fire mountains, Aras Thelduin. The trees of long ago appeared taller, straighter, and less foreboding, and throughout the valley the riders' buildings stood intact, glowing like pale beacons in the dusk, with the soft light from the elves' flameless lanterns. Less ivy and moss covered the ochre stone then, and the halls and towers seemed noble in a way that the ruins did not. And along the cobblestone pathways and high overhead, Aragorn discerned the glittering shapes of numerous dragons, graceful giants with the treasure of a thousand kings upon their hides. The apparition lasted for a moment longer, then Glader released Aragorn's mind, and the valley once more appeared as it was.
"It was beautiful," said Aragorn.
"That it was, but no more."
Aragorn continued to study the valley, comparing it to what Glader had shown him, and he frowned when he saw a line of bobbing lights, lanterns, he thought, within the abandoned city. He whispered a spell to sharpen his sight, and was able to make out a line of hooded figures in dark robes, walking slowly through the ruins. They seemed solemn and unearthly, and there was a ritualistic quality to the measured beats of their strides and to the patterned sway of their lanterns.
"Who are they?" he asked Glader.
He felt as if he was witnessing something not meant for others to see.
"I do not know. Perhaps they are the descendants of those who hid during the battle. Perhaps they are men of your race who thought to settle here after the fall of the Riders. Or perhaps they are those who worship dragons and riders as gods."
"Are there really such?"
There were. We discouraged the practice, but even so, it was common in many of the more isolated parts of Alagaesia. It is good, I think, that you placed the wards you did.
Aragorn watched as the hooded figures wound their way across the city, which took almost an hour. Once they arrived at the far side, the lanterns winked out one by one. At where the lantern holders had gone, Aragorn could not see, even with the assistance of magic. Then Aragorn banked the fire with handfuls of dirt and crawled under his blankets to rest.
Aragorn, Saphira, rouse yourselves!
Aragorn's eyes snapped open. He sat upright and grabbed Brisinga. All was dark, save for the dull red glow of the bed of coals to his right, and a ragged patch of starry sky off to the east. Though the light was faint, Aragorn was able to make out the general shape of the forest and the meadow, and the monstrously large snail that was sliding across the grass toward him. Aragorn yelped and scrambled backward. The snail, whose shell was over 5.5 feet tall, hesitated, then slimed toward him as fast as a man could run. A snake-like hiss came from the black slit of its mouth, and its waving eyeballs were each the size of his fist. Aragorn realized that he would not have time to get to his feet, and on his back he did not have the space he needed to draw Brisinga. He prepared to cast a spell, but before he could, Saphira's head arrowed past him, and she caught the snail about the middle with her jaws. The snail's shell cracked between her fangs with a sound like breaking slate, and the creature uttered a faint, quavering shriek. With a twist of her neck, Saphira tossed the snail into the air, opened her mouth as wide as it would go, and swallowed the creature whole, bobbing her head twice as she did, like a robin eating an earthworm. Lowering his gaze, Aragorn saw four more giant snails farther down upon the rise. One of the creatures had retreated within its shell. The others were hurrying away upon their undulating skirt-like bellies. "Over there!" shouted Aragorn. Saphira leaped forward. Her entire body left the ground for a moment, and then she landed upon all fours and snapped up first one, then two, then three of the snails. She did not eat the last snail, the one hiding in its shell, but drew back her head and bathed it in a stream of blue and yellow flame that lit up the land for hundreds of feet in every direction. She maintained the flame for no more than a second or two. Then she picked up the smoking, steaming snail between her jaws as gently as a mother cat picking up a kitten, carried it over to Aragorn, and dropped it at his feet. He eyed it with distrust, but it appeared well and truly dead.
"Now you can have a proper breakfast," said Saphira.
He stared at her, then began to laugh. And he kept laughing until he was doubled over, resting his hands on his knees and heaving for breath.
"What is so amusing?"
she asked, and sniffed the soot-blackened shell.
"Yes, why do you laugh, Aragorn?"
asked Bleda. He shook his head and continued to wheeze. At last he was able to say, "Because," and then he shifted to speaking with his mind so that Bleda would hear as well. "Because snails and eggs," and he began to giggle again, feeling very silly. "Because snail steaks. Hungry? Have a stalk. Feeling tired? Eat an eyeball. Who needs mead when you have slime? I could put the stalks in a cup like a bunch of flowers, and they would—" He was laughing so hard he found it impossible to continue, and he dropped to one knee while he gasped for air, tears of mirth streaming from his eyes. Saphira parted her jaws in a toothy approximation of a smile, and she made a soft choking sound in her throat.
"You are very odd sometimes, Aragorn."
He could feel his merriment infecting her. She sniffed the shell again.
"Some mead would be nice."
"At least you ate," he said, both with his mind and his tongue.
"Not enough, but enough to return to the Varden."